MacCast, Sunday, November 11th, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to be sitting here with you for another week of Apple and Mac news. We don't have a ton of things to talk about, but there are some interesting stories happening this week that we're going to get into. We're going to talk about iPhone XR expectations and how it's doing so far and how we think it's going to do. You can finally, or maybe very soon, we'll be able to buy a nice Pilsner using Apple Pay. I'll explain that in a second. Also, Apple Watch fixes are out, along with a few other service programs that I want to make you aware of. We got some questions about what's happening with next generation AirPods, and also reviews of the Mac Mini are in, and they're looking pretty good. And that's going to round out the news for this week. And then we're going to get into some of your feedback. I'm going to share my impressions on Apple's new iPad Pro. Yep, I got one of those in-house and have had some time to spend with it, and I'll give you my thoughts and impressions on that. We're going to get a little more into Apple's price-to-value proposition when it comes to their new products. I got some great feedback from you and also some additional insights to share with you in this episode. And also, we're going to round out with some tips and advice on keeping those older Macs alive and in service and running, as we've been talking about. You know, our Macs are serving us for longer periods of time. I shared with you my thoughts that I think Apple is wanting us to keep and use our machines for longer. So we're going to give you some tips and advice on how to do that. And that will round out this episode of the MacCast. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors. And that sponsor is Ops Genie by Atlassian. You know, if you think about our world today, we have come to rely so much on software and web services. We have a lot of things that are up in the cloud. I know I do. And anytime those services are down, think about Apple's services. Anytime they're down, you can't access your iCloud, you can't access your Apple Music. That is a huge deal for us, right? It is a big inconvenience. But what if you're the person, and a lot of you are, in charge of keeping those services up and going, making sure that they're reliable? You're on a dev or an ops team. You know how critical it is that you need to be able to respond quickly to any kinds of events or things that might be happening. You know, incidents are inevitable, and it really comes down to how your company can respond. It requires a complex coordination between your operations and your software development teams. You know, really the unsung heroes of your organization that are putting fires out every day, and getting immediate alerts is critical when those incidents do occur. And that's why there's Ops Genie by Atlassian. It gives your teams the power to respond quickly and efficiently to unplanned issues. It also helps notify the right people in your organization with a combination of smart scheduling and escalation paths that take into account things like time zones and holidays, so it reaches the right people who are ready and on call and ready to respond to things. It also allows for deep flexibility in how, when, and where those alerts are deployed, and it's supported by over 200 integrations with services like Jira, Amazon CloudWatch, Datadog, New Relic, and more. And it will also track all of that activity, providing useful insights to help you improve and get better at responding to future incidents. With Ops Genie, your next incident doesn't stand a chance. Visit opsgenie.com to sign up for a free company account and add up to 5 team members today. That's opsgenie.com. Never miss a critical alert again with Ops Genie. And a big thank you to Atlassian and Ops Genie for their support of the MacCast. Oh, that supply chain. You know that supply chain that we often talk about. Not Tim Cook's favorite thing, right? He's always told us not to trust it. Turns out this week they have some thoughts along with analysts on what's happening with iPhone XR production and what that possibly means for iPhone XR sales and just the overall success this year of Apple's latest iPhone lineup. We got a report this week from Nikkei Asian Review. They're saying that Apple has told their suppliers like Foxconn and Pegatron to reduce the number of iPhone XRs they're producing, actually slow down the production lines. As a matter of fact, the report says that Foxconn was originally prepping about 60 lines to produce the iPhone XR, and Apple has been only using about 45 of those. So you got 15 lines, if you believe this report, kind of sitting there idle. And the report claims that Foxconn has been adjusting things and will be producing 20 to 25% fewer iPhones for Apple, reducing the number of units per week by about 100,000. Now, belief from analysts is that this is because there's been lower than expected orders from Apple for the iPhone, and that is because there is just not enough demand, and that Apple actually has already, because they ramp up in the lead up to a launch, they've already ramped up enough that they have enough supplies in the supply chain to get them through the holiday quarter based on their latest projections. The report also claims that Apple is asking their manufacturers to actually up the production of iPhone 8 and iPhone 8 Plus models, presumably because those models are selling through a little bit better than Apple has expected. So all of those things, if you want to take them in aggregate, kind of give analysts this picture that, oh, well, maybe iPhone XR, XS, and XS Max aren't sort of capturing the hearts and minds of consumers, and consumers are going with the lower cost options. Maybe some consumers who are even waiting for this year's iPhones have decided, nope, you know what, the 8, 8 Plus is going to be enough for me. Now, that being said, you know, Apple continuously analyzes demand. They're constantly making adjustments to their supply chain. And again, the supply chain is historically unreliable. As a matter of fact, Nikkei Asian Review really has a mixed track record at understanding and analyzing these things, as do a lot of analysts. So, you know, only Apple really knows what's going on with this stuff. And until they actually give us numbers, say at a quarterly results call, which they're not going to be doing anymore, we talked about that last week, we really don't know how iPhones are selling. We can only look at the profit margins, how Apple is doing as a company, what they're making on their products to kind of really gauge that, especially moving forward. So I always say take these reports with a grain of salt. It maybe does indicate some things, but it could possibly just be that Apple overproduced in the lead up. And yes, they have enough in the supply chain, but that doesn't necessarily mean that iPhone XR is not going to sell well or it is going to be perceived as a failure. A lot of times what analysts and industry pundits think is a failure, Apple doesn't see as a failure at all, and most reasonable people wouldn't see as a failure at all. So a lot of kind of panic over this in the news this week. I don't think it's panic time. I think the iPhone XR is still going to be a huge seller. I think it's going to be a huge seller through the holidays, and I think when Apple goes to announce their quarterly results, that is going to show it. Does that mean that iPhone 8 and 8 Plus aren't also going to be great sellers? No, I think they are as well. I think Apple was very smart to leave those models in the lineup, and I think they're going to be very popular. I've heard from people in the MacCast community who have said exactly that. You know, I was waiting for the new updates. I wanted to see what Apple's going to do, but I still like Touch ID. I still like a lot of the features of these older models, and at the reduced price point, I think I'm going to go ahead and upgrade to one of those. And there's certainly nothing wrong with that. It plays right into the conversation we've been having over the past few weeks about the fact that older Apple hardware is still really good hardware, even with the new stuff being out there. And if you can save some money on it, I think consumers will respond to that as well. Overall, I think the important thing is that Apple is selling iPhones. And I don't think that Apple internally is too concerned about which model, because they have healthy profit margins built into every unit that they sell. So regardless of which ones they're selling, they're going to do well. And of course, it makes sense for them to analyze and adjust supplies accordingly based on what they think they're going to sell. So I think that's all that's really going on here. No need to panic, but something to kind of keep an eye on and take a look at. Oh my gosh, great news for those of you in Germany who have been waiting. It's looking like we're finally on the cusp of Germany getting Apple Pay. Apple has, they're sort of cutting it close because they had promised you in Germany that you would have Apple Pay in 2018. We've got just a few months left. Well, information went up on Apple's website, German website, also on the website of one of the German banks that's going to be supporting Apple Pay, Hypo Vereinsbank. Hopefully I'm saying that right. I'm probably mutilating it, and you German listeners can tell me that. But it's looking like it is coming. They just say coming soon, though. Unfortunately, they don't actually give you a date. And there's a number of banks that are going to be supporting it in the region, and they're saying it should have support for American Express, MasterCard, and Visa cards. They should all be compatible. So your long national nightmare is over. You're finally getting Apple Pay, and it's amazing that it's been delayed this long, because Apple Pay in Germany is continental Europe's biggest economy. And as to why it's taken so long, well, it's the typical thing, the thing that Apple has been struggling with in every country they roll out, and it's, you know, disagreements over the transaction fees, over the cut that Apple is going to be taking and how much of a cut the bank gets to keep. And so they've been going supposedly round and round on that, and it looks like they finally gotten close to reaching a decision. So great news for those of you in Germany. Also, Apple Pay is reportedly coming to Belgium later this month. So Apple continues to roll out Apple Pay. And we do know from the last quarterly results call that Apple Pay transaction volume was like triple year over year. So Apple Pay finally starting to take off. We're seeing it in a lot more retailers here in the U.S., a lot bigger retailers are starting to support it. We did get CVS finally coming on board with Apple Pay and giving up on that whole currency thing that they tried to do. And I think we're going to see more and more retailers falling. And as more and more retailer support comes into play, I think you're going to see more and more folks using Apple Pay. And I've been using Apple Pay personally in a lot more places, and I'm super excited about that because it is just incredibly convenient. As a matter of fact, the other day, we're starting to see it in gas stations here. I was able to actually use it at a mobile gas station, and thank goodness, because I had forgotten my wallet at home that day and I really needed gas. So in some cases, it even ends up being a lifesaver. And I've gotten reports from a lot of you who are using Apple Pay more and more as well. And it works so well, so much faster than taking out your credit card, at least in my opinion. So share your Apple Pay experiences with us. And especially once you start seeing it in Germany, let us know when it actually goes live. Like I said, we don't have a hard date on it yet, but it should be happening sometime soon, at least before the end of the year. I think it was last week we were mentioning some of the iOS and iDevice updates that came out, and one of those was watchOS 5.1. But unfortunately, after Apple released it, they had to pull it, I think even the same day, because there were some sporadic reports of the update actually bricking some Apple Watches, causing them to become completely non-functional, to the point where Apple was reportedly having to replace Apple Watches to fix it. Like, they could not be recovered. We don't really know what was happening, but Apple did pull the report. I think I shared with you the fact that I did have a problem with the Apple Watch update, but it was just that it was really, really slow. It took, I think, over an hour for the update to run on my Apple Watch. Luckily, I left it running and it worked, but I think in some people's cases, it ran for 3 or 4 hours and just never updated. And when they went to reboot the phone, Apple Watch, and try and get control back, it ended up being non-functional. Well, good news now. Apple has released or re-released the watchOS update. watchOS 5.1.1 is out now, supposedly fixes those issues. Unfortunately, if you were impacted by the original bricking problem, 5.1.1 is not going to do anything for you because you're actually not able to access your Apple Watch. So if you're in that situation, you are still going to need to contact Apple Care and possibly send in your Apple Watch for repair or replacement. As far as what the update brings, it does include the original bug fixes and minor improvements, along with a few new features, support for group FaceTime calls via audio, also the new emojis that were in the latest round of updates, and some new customized watch faces, including a new update to the color watch face that allows you, if you have an Apple Watch Series 4, to change the entire color of the face of your watch to a single color or a gradation. And also, if you're on older Apple Watches, you can get a round version of that same face. So that update is available now. It does seem to be working for people, so it's probably safe to upgrade at this point. Also this week, Apple announced a couple of new repair programs. If you are an owner of an iPhone X and you have a display that has become unresponsive, you may be able to get your device repaired even if you're out of warranty. Apple has announced a new iPhone X display module replacement program. Apple says some iPhone X displays can experience problems with responsiveness due to the display module component that can actually fail. The symptoms are your display or part of your display that doesn't respond to touch or responds intermittently, or if you have a display that doesn't react at all when it's being touched, then you are likely impacted. They are offering the replacement program. There's no kind of sense. They haven't announced or said which units are affected. Sometimes they'll give you a range of units sold between certain dates. So it's feeling like on this one, it could be almost anybody with an iPhone X that could be impacted. Is just random. Obviously, you will know if you have the issue because you're experiencing some of the problems we just described. If you are in that group, you are advised to contact Apple Retail or Apple Care or take your device to an Apple authorized service provider for service. And again, they are going to cover this issue under this new program. So don't worry if you're even out of warranty. Get your iPhone X in there and get it fixed. Another program that was also announced is an SSD service program for the 13-inch MacBook Pro non-touch bar edition, specifically the models with 128 or 256 gigabytes of flash storage. A limited number of these machines reportedly have an issue that can result in data loss or failure of the drive. These are models sold, Apple says, between June 2017 and June 2018, so a little over a year ago, or over the past year, I guess I should say. Apple says they will provide service for these drives free of charge, service or I would assume replacement in a lot of cases. So if you do have one of the impacted models, you're going to want to make sure that you run a full backup if you can, and then get it into Apple or an Apple authorized service provider for service. If you want to check, in this case, Apple does have a page up on their support website. I will link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. You can check if your model is in the impacted group and if you are eligible for the service. So check the show notes at maccast.com for those links. And again, this is for the 13-inch MacBook Pro non-touch bar model. If you have one of the other models, they are not part of this service program. Over the past couple months, of course, we got a lot of new updated Apple products, including new Macs and new iPads and iPhones and all that good stuff. But there were a few items that were predicted to possibly be updated that just never really surfaced. And one of those products is Apple's AirPods. We are expecting at some point Apple to do a revision of their AirPods. There's some speculation about what might be in there. What we really don't know is when is that update happening. But this week we saw a little hint, a little indication that Apple is at least working on something and it could surface relatively soon, Apple received a Bluetooth SIG certification for what could possibly be the next generation of AirPods. There was actually two listings that were cited in a report, and both of them mention an update to Bluetooth 5.0, which would seem like a logical next iteration for the AirPods because it would bring improved range and better battery life. The report, of course, doesn't give us any indication of when it will happen, just that Apple has filed for certification. Now, interestingly, they do cite AirPods as the product in the listing, so it's not really hidden in there. And we've also, of course, heard reports or rumors that Apple is working on a next generation that would include additional noise cancellation, possibly some new health features like tracking and recording heart rate data. Somehow through the AirPods themselves. And of course, we are still waiting on and expecting Apple's Air Power Mat along with that wireless charging case, both of those items which were announced way back in 2017, but still haven't seen the light of day yet. Now, do I believe any of these products are coming this year? I think maybe the AirPod update could and the wireless charging case, although we would need a charging system to charge that. Rumor is that the wireless charging case would be compatible, completely compatible with Qi wireless charging. So I think Apple could release that without their own AirPower Mat. But my gut says that they do want to release all of those items together, and very often Apple does have some sort of spring event. So I'm going to go out on a limb and predict that, yes, these things are in the works. Apple is working on them. Apple is actively planning an update, but that the update will happen not this year, but next year, sometime in the spring time frame, and mainly because I think Apple's kind of done with products. Usually by the time we get through the October announcements, Apple's kind of done with product announcements for the year. This is the lineup that's going to get them through the holidays, and then at the beginning of the year, we start to see some new things surface. And this seems prime for some sort of an event, especially in the spring, if they're going to announce things like Apple's new television service and maybe updates to Apple Music services and just do a general kind of music media announcement sometime in the spring. I think that will happen. And we'll just have to wait and see if I'm right or not. But what do you think? Are you excited about new AirPods and some of the AirPod features we've been hearing about? I know a lot of you are still hoping for that AirPower Mat. You know my personal opinion on it is I think it's a vaporware product. I think Apple couldn't quite work out the system that they wanted to work out, even though they thought they could. And I think it'll just quietly fade into oblivion. But I'm happy to be wrong and hope that I am wrong. But let us know your opinion, maccast@gmail.com. And then I want to round out the news for this week with some reviews of the Mac Mini. You know, Apple announced that new Mac Mini, and it was a little bit controversial in our community, I have to say. Some folks feeling like the $300 price increase on the base price wasn't really justified, and we've been talking about that here on the MacCast. We're going to talk about it more here in a minute, just in general. But getting back to the Mac Mini, early reviews are coming in, and they're, I would say, generally very positive. The Mac Mini getting a lot of love, not only from Apple in terms of the specifications, but also from the folks that have had a chance to play around with it. And I think what we're almost universally hearing about the Mac Mini is that what's amazing about this year's model is the ability to for it to adapt to be almost anything to a wide range of folks. And I think that totally makes sense with how the Mac Mini just sort of organically evolved. It was originally, if you remember, designed to be this machine for switchers, right? This lower cost option, lower barrier to entry for people moving over from Windows. But slowly it evolved into a machine that was being used for server farms, was being used for render farms, was being used for a lot more pro applications. People were building them into media centers and all those sorts of things. And I think Apple recognized recognized the versatility of that platform. And I think with this year's update, even though it was a long time in coming, I think they recognized that. And they added this ability to configure all kinds of options. And along with that came all kinds of price points. So it becomes very interesting, the fact that you can get in a Mac Mini starting at $799, $800, but you can custom configure one all the way up to $4,200, which just seems insane for a Mac Mini if you are stuck in the mindset of, oh, this was supposed to be a low-cost entry-level machine for Apple. It isn't that anymore, and I think that's what a lot of these early reviews are responding to. Of course, you can get the base-priced model with an Intel i3 quad-core processor, but that processor, even though it's an i3, is really no slouch. It's running at 3.6 gigahertz. That entry-level model does come with a limited amount of storage at 128 gigabytes, but you get that for $700, and you could add external storage. I think it's still a pretty fair entry price point. And as a matter of fact, a lot of the reviews have pointed out that if you look at similarly sized and spec'd PC models that are out there, Apple's right in the same price range. So it's not exorbitantly priced for what you're getting in terms of processor, in terms of flash storage, and all those sorts of things. Of course, it's gotten a little bit more expensive because Apple has abandoned the lower cost spinning drives and gone with pure flash-based storage. But then you can configure that Mac Mini with an i5, with an i7, up to 6 cores, up to 64 gigabytes of RAM, up to 2 terabytes of fast PCIe flash storage. And it's important to remember that Apple is using their high-quality storage, the same stuff they would put in an iMac or a Mac Pro. So it's not like the Mac Mini is getting less in terms of components. These are high-quality components. And another big advantage of the Mac Mini when it comes to versatility is just the ports for connectivity. It has 4 Thunderbolt 3 USB-C ports, more than any other Mac out there other than the Mac Pro. Even the iMac doesn't get that. 2 USB-A ports or USB 3.0 ports, HDMI 2.0, audio out, and 1 gigabit Ethernet, which you can also configure up to 10 gigabit Ethernet if you need that. Again, looking at some of the more pro applications and places where the Mac Mini is being deployed. And it really represents Apple's most flexible option for a desktop machine when it comes to different kinds of applications. It can be your entry-level machine. It can be a render farm or a software compiler beast. It can be a video editing station. Of course, its big Achilles heel there is the integrated processor, but it has full support for an eGPU. So you tack on an eGPU, Thunderbolt 3 RAID, and you have a very, very capable video editing machine, something that can probably even give a iMac Pro or a Mac Pro a run for its money. Is it going to best it? Maybe, maybe not, but it's certainly going to do a very good job. And of course, you can cover everything in between that. So from entry level all the way up to pro applications. And I think that's what the community is responding to. And again, performance-wise, it's doing very well. A topped-out CPU model of a Mac Mini can hang in with the best of anything that Apple has to offer right now, including the iMac Pro and the Mac Pro. So it's really cool to see people actually running the iMac, or the Mac Mini rather, through its paces now. And some of you have even wrote in to tell me that you've received your Mac Minis and you're super excited about them. And that's great to see in the community, because I am personally a huge fan of the Mac Mini and the form factor. I have one in my house, a 2014 model, as a matter of fact, what a lot of people consider to be, I think, kind of like the downgraded, not great version of the Mac Mini. The 2012 is usually regarded as a better version of the Mac Mini, but we love ours. I mean, once I swapped out the spinning drive for an SSD, it offers really, really great performance. And I have to say, too, the Mac Mini outside of the Mac Pro is arguably now currently, because you can swap the RAM out, Apple's most consumer upgradable Mac. If you are a DIY person, you can do a RAM upgrade in the Mac Mini. Now, we've gotten a little more details about that. Of course, Apple is recommending that you use an Apple authorized service provider to do that upgrade and not do it yourself, but you can do it yourself without voiding your warranty, but it's certainly not for the faint of heart. iFixit actually posted their teardown this week, and as I suspected, unfortunately, it's not just as easy as popping off the bottom cover and the plate and, you know, and pulling out the antenna array and then accessing the RAM, which looks like it's right there. But it's actually covered up by some flash shielding, and actually you can't get access to it just through the bottom of the Mac Mini. You do have to pop out the entire logic board, and that does involve tearing it down to a significant degree. Now, it's not necessarily hard. You do need some, and you don't even need some specialized tools because it uses standard Torx screws. But if you do accidentally damage it, Apple's obviously not going to cover any of that damage under your warranty. So just be careful if you are going to be doing the RAM upgrade yourself. If you've done a SSD swap in a Mac Mini, you're going to be very used to the procedure. The one nice thing is you don't have to use the special logic board pry tool, because you can actually push on the fan housing to pop that logic board out of the Mac Mini. Now, you're going to want to be very careful when you do that, and it's even noted in the iFixit teardown that where you place your thumbs on that fan assembly and cooling system is really important, because the little fins that are in there are pretty delicate, the cooling fins, so you don't want to break those off. And again, you got to be careful, but you can swap out the RAM on your own if you're willing to do it, which is a nice thing. And that means the Mac Mini is pretty upgradable. And with all those ports, you do also have a lot of upgrade and expansion options, meaning that if you invest in a Mac Mini now, you're probably going to be able to run that thing for a pretty good amount of time. I would expect to get at least 4 or 5 years out of good use out of a Mac Mini, maybe even longer at this point. So I think it's overall a great machine. I'm super excited about it. Yes, it is a little bit more expensive, but you are getting a little bit more value and quality straight out of the box day one. And I think that's what you're paying for a little bit. So the other thing that got tore down, of course, is Apple's new MacBook Air. It's also getting pretty good reviews in the press, but the teardown has a few confirmations and even a couple of surprises for us. It was confirmed that the butterfly keyboard design that's in there is Apple's third generation design with that membrane. So that's good news, because it should mean that it won't suffer from some of the keyboard problems and dead key issues that some of the earlier Mac models with that version of the keyboard, the Apple's butterfly keyboard, had. So that shouldn't be an issue. As far as opening it up, it does require a pentalobe screwdriver. So Apple using those special screws, kind of an indication that they really don't want you getting into the MacBook Air. And you really shouldn't need to get in there to do anything, because there aren't really any user upgradable parts. Of course, that changes if you need to get your Mac or your MacBook Air serviced. And the good news there is that iFixit did discover that a number of the components, the Thunderbolt 3 ports and the Touch ID sensor, all of those things are in little modular boards. So they are much more serviceable. Also, the battery and the speakers are still glued in, but they're attached with pull to remove adhesive tabs. So they're much easier to get off of the case. Even though they're still glued in there, you can just pull on the adhesive tabs. Those will pop off and you'll be able to get those components out easier. So that's great news for future longevity of your MacBook Air, when the battery inevitably does need to be swapped out and you need to take it in for service. They'll be able to service it a little bit more easily. And overall, that's good news. Now, iFixit did still give it a 3 out of 10 for repairability, which I don't find all too surprising because it's not easy to get in there. And again, it's not, there's not a lot of parts that you're going to want to service yourself. It's really going to be the kind of thing where most of us would be taking it to an Apple authorized reseller or back into Apple for service or repairs. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another couple show sponsors, starting off with Finn. You know, if you're like me, and I bet you are, you're struggling every day to keep on top of all of the tasks that you need to do. I find that I have to focus on like the big critical items for the day. My responsibilities, say, to my clients for building and maintaining their websites, doing things to stay on top of all of the MacCast emails and research and show prep that I need to do. And I often reach the end of the day, and a lot of the extraneous items, especially personal to-do items, seem to fall through the cracks. Things like scheduling medical appointments, contacting the plumber to have him take care of that leak under the sink, or just researching stuff like that much-needed vacation that I want to take. All those little things fall through the cracks, they get pushed off, and likely never get done, which is frustrating not only for me, but also for my wife and the rest of my family. And that's why I'm excited now to have access to Finn. Finn is a personal assistant that you don't need to spend time recruiting, training, or managing. It integrates machine learning backed by real, actual people, and Finn can get things done for you. As a matter of fact, it can do almost anything. Things like scheduling meetings, answering your phone calls, handling travel plans, finding and booking services like haircuts or spa treatments if you want, even making hotel or dinner reservations. Basically, Finn does everything for you that a great assistant can do without the cost or time commitments of a full-time hire. That's because with Finn, you only pay for what you use. And what's great about Finn is it's available 24/7, 365 days a year, and you have multiple ways where you can give Finn tasks. You can do it via email, via phone. There's even Slack integration. And of course, they have their website and an app available for you to use. And Finn learns your preferences over time, gets faster and smarter. As a matter of fact, just this week, I had Finn help me compile a list of iPad specs and prices for some MacCast research that I wanted to do and deliver it to me in a Google document. That was a couple of hours freed up for me to focus on other things. It was super helpful. And if Finn is helping me, I know Finn can help you become more productive as well. It can also help you grow your business. That's why I've arranged for you to try out Finn for free. You'll get a $60 credit for your first month of use if you use my link, finn.com/MacCast. And if you use that link, they're even waiving their usual 20-month minimum fee for the life of your account. Just make sure that you use my URL. That's finn.com/MacCast, all lowercase, to try Finn for free. finn.com/MacCast, and a big thank you to Finn for their support of the show. I'd also like to thank Cachefly for their support. Cachefly's web optimization solution. You know, when websites don't load, we tend to lose interest. Every second a page takes to load costs a company about 16% in engagement. And fewer visits to your website means fewer customers, which is not good for anyone. So when it comes to website optimization, Cachefly has your back. With their new web optimization capabilities, all of your content will be optimized before it's delivered to your visitors without requiring any development effort from you. With the recent addition of Cachefly's flexible Edge application platform and implementation services, their capabilities reach far beyond those of any traditional CDN. Cachefly's web optimization solution includes powerful APIs for solving content distribution problems, on-the-fly next-generation image optimization, application load balancing, and smart asset delivery. Listen, if your website is directly tied to your revenue, and you know it is, optimize your site's content now. Guarantee the best user experience for all of your customers, no matter where they are or what device they're using today. I've been using CacheFly here at the MacCast for years. They are a great company, and they're really great people. As a matter of fact, they're even going to provide free optimization consultation for listeners of this podcast. That's right, just for you. You can get some free optimization consultation and know exactly where your site stands. They will give you a Lighthouse score report and help you learn how CacheFly's web optimization solutions can help add 60 points instantly to your score. All you have to do is visit mac.cachefly.com. That's mac.cachefly, cachefly.com, mac.cachefly.com today, and you'll get that consultation completely for free. And a huge thank you to CacheFly for their support of the MacCast. So Apple's new iPad Pros, the iPad Pro 11-inch and the iPad Pro 12.9-inch third generation shipped this past week, and I decided that it was time to upgrade my iPad Pro. I had an original first generation 12.9-inch iPad Pro, which I have to tell you, I absolutely love, but I was super excited by the new design, some of the new features. I also was excited to be able to try out the new Apple Pencil, so I decided to bite the bullet, spend the money, and it was not cheap, I have to tell you, spend the money and buy a new iPad Pro. Now, interestingly, I decided to go with the 11-inch model, and that's because when the 10.5-inch model came out, I had a chance to try it out in the Apple Store, play around with it, and I thought, you know, this is a really nice size. To be honest, the 12.9-inch iPad Pro is huge. It is a massive beast, or rather, it was, and I'm saying this and telling this to you because I still, as I sit here recording this podcast, I'm not entirely convinced I made the right decision in downsizing my upgrade to an 11-inch iPad Pro. I think I'm going to need more time to live with that decision. So I'm kind of finding that, unlike with my iPhone where I want a smaller device, I'm thinking with iPad Pros, I tend to want a larger device. Maybe that's because I'm looking at it almost like a laptop supplement, or in a lot of ways, a laptop replacement. When I leave the house, I find more and more that I leave with my iPad Pro, my 12.9-inch, and now my new 11-inch, than I do with my 15-inch MacBook Pro. But I am, in some ways, really enjoying the smaller, more compact size, but in other areas, like when I'm using apps in split-screen mode, I'm kind of missing the larger screen. And a lot of the reviews that came out of the new 12.9-inch form factor, because it loses a lot of its large dimensions, you know, it goes edge-to-edge on the screen, but it gets actually physically smaller than the 12.9-inch, a lot of people are really thinking that that's sort of the ideal size. I think Apple said it's about the same size as a sheet of 8.5 by 11 paper, which that would actually be really nice to have that big of a screen in that compact of form factor. But I wanted to share with you just some of my early thoughts and impressions. I've only had, you know, what is it, about a week or so, actually less than a week of time spent with the new iPad Pro, but I want to give my early impressions and also maybe get some of your thoughts and impressions if you have upgraded, or maybe if you haven't upgraded, share with us, you know, what you're thinking about this year's iPads. But I have to tell you, starting off with number one, the unboxing experience, as expected from Apple, absolutely lovely. Everything was packaged perfectly. Interestingly, everything did come shipped in its own box. So I ordered an iPad Pro, an Apple Pencil, and a Smart Folio. They all came individually in separate boxes. Actually, even with their own tracking numbers, I received three different shipping numbers. I'm not sure how that sort of resolves with Apple's whole, hey, we care about the environment sort of thing. Although I will tell you, every one of the packages, individual packages, was perfectly sized for the device that it came in. So maybe Maybe that's better. Rather than having one big box with three things in it, you've got three boxes that are the exact size that they need to be and are pretty compact. And of course, opening up those boxes was nice. They have nice little pull tabs on them now, even to the point, with the exception of the Folio, the Smart Folio keyboard, both the iPad and the Apple Pencil actually had little pull tabs for opening up the plastic shrink wrap that's around them. And of course, they were boxed beautifully, and the whole experience was what you had come to expect from Apple. I was a little disappointed that there weren't some teeny tiny Apple stickers in the Apple Pencil box. No stickers in there, but there was some nice documentation, and it was all presented very, very well, as you would expect from Apple. One of my first experiences was attaching the new Smart Folio keyboard and the Apple Pencil to my new iPad Pro. And all I can say is magnets, awesome. There's like 129 in there, something like that, crazy for snapping on the Smart Folio keyboard to the back. And I was worried a little bit about the new Smart Connector being in that odd position. But the Smart Folio keyboard fits beautifully over the square edges of that iPad and doesn't add any bulk whatsoever. I mean, very minimal amount of additional bulk. I shouldn't say none, because of course it is adding something, but so minimized with that whole magnetic attaching system. And it feels safe and secure. I haven't had any problems with that. Same thing with the Apple Pencil, snaps right into place. I will tell you, that's not quite as good. It's a little bit odd, and especially I've heard from some folks who don't have the Smart Folio keyboard and just have the Apple Pencil. The Apple Pencil is actually just a hair thicker, I think, in terms of dimensions than the thickness of the iPad itself. So when you're putting that flat down on a table, the concern would be that it actually pushes on the Apple Pencil a little bit. It shouldn't be too much, and it shouldn't come detached from that magnet. Also, you've got the camera bump on the back if you're not using the Smart Folio keyboard. So that would, I would presume, lift it off the table just enough to kind of clear the Apple Pencil, but still a little bit of a concern. And I have bumped that Apple Pencil enough to knock it off of its magnetic mount. As a matter of fact, one time that the pencil did fall and got a little bit scuffed, which I wasn't too thrilled about. But in general, I'm not finding it coming detached. It does seem to stick there. And it's great. It goes right into charging mode the minute it sits in there. You get a nice little pop-up display that shows its charging and the charging percentage, which is really nice. Very different than having to go into the widgets and attaching, you know, the Apple Pencil awkwardly to the Lightning port like you had to do with the previous generation models. So I'm enjoying that experience thoroughly. Setting up the new iPad was completely magical with Apple's quick setup. Can I just tell you, because I've been hearing from many of you that you don't use the quick setup feature with your iPhone or your iPad. And if you haven't done it, you need to do it, especially if you're doing iCloud backups, which if you're not, I would also encourage you to do. Even if you have to pay for the extra storage, it's well worth it. I am backing up my iPad that way, iPad and iPhone, to the cloud. I also do it locally in iTunes. When I'm doing an upgrade, I'll just do one manual sync. But in general, I'm using iCloud backup, which means I can use the magical feature of quick setup. And for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, now when you get a new iOS device, what you can do is you can take one iOS device, hold it near the other device, they will recognize each other, and then you get the little Apple Watch, I don't know what you call that sort of orb thing. You point the camera basically of one device at the other device, and they will sync up and automatically transfer over all of your settings, all of your apps. It will completely upgrade everything automagically. And within minutes, literally within minutes of that wizard running, I had my new iPad set up and ready to go. I didn't have to re-enter my network passwords. I didn't have to fiddle with any of the settings. I didn't even have to reset up my wallpaper. All of that stuff was magically transferred over. Now, the only thing that doesn't get transferred over is logins and things for third-party apps. So if you use a third-party email client or third-party applications, you will have to redo some of those logins. But again, if you have something like 1Password or a password manager, that doesn't end up being too difficult. And again, I was up and running very, very quickly, and I absolutely love it. So I can't say enough about Quick Setup. You should use it, and don't worry about, you know, bringing stuff over. Our iOS devices aren't like our Macs. You don't generally need to do a clean erase and install unless you're specifically having issues with your current models, like big time issues. I think you can get away with just doing the Quick Setup. So that's my plug for that. I kind of gushed on that a little bit, so sorry about it. But it's just really, really cool. I already talked about the size a little bit. It's definitely much smaller than my 12.9-inch first-gen iPad Pro. It feels manageable. I don't really like the small on-screen keyboard, and I will tell you the Smart Folio keyboard does feel a lot more cramped than the one was on my iPad, the one that was on my iPad Pro. So I am finding typing a little bit difficult, but I think that's just a process of adapting. It's getting better the more I'm using it, but you know, otherwise I'm more or less happy with the size. Ask me in a couple weeks if I still feel the same way. You know, if the transition hasn't not gone well, I might feel a little bit differently, but not enough to trade it in. I will stick with this size for a year at least, and probably a couple years until I'm going to upgrade my iPad again, and then I may bump back to the larger size. The Apple Pencil 2 is, or Apple number 2 pencil, as I'm calling it, is really, really nice. It's got this nice, silky, grippy finish on it. I like it a lot better than the previous generation Apple Pencil. It's also actually just a little bit shorter than the first generation Apple Pencil. That's because it doesn't have the lightning connector on the end. It does connect, you know, wirelessly via the magnetic connection on the side of the iPad. It feels great in your hand, and surprisingly feels even better on the glass, almost like paper, a pencil on paper. There's actually some sort of grip to it, a little bit of tooth that wasn't there before with the previous generation. And I was trying to figure out why that is. You know, is it something in the glass? Is it something in the pencil itself? I actually think Apple slightly changed the tip of the pencil. And I know you can get replacement tips, so I don't know if that means you could change the feel on the first generation Apple Pencil or not. But I was looking at the tips of my first gen Apple Pencil versus this new one, and it does look like the original one is kind of shiny and glossy. This one has more of a matte finish, similar to the finish of the pencil itself. And I have a feeling that is what's making it feel a little bit more like it has a tooth when you're using it. And either way, you know, whatever is causing that, whether it's a change in the glass, whether it's a change in the pencil or the tip of the pencil itself or both, it's really, really nice. It feels just great using that on the iPad. And I'm going to, I think even because of that, want to use the Apple Pencil more and more. I'm finding the Apple Pencil handy just as even a pointing device. As much as Steve Jobs has said, you know, styluses, yuck, I'm feeling like Apple Pencil stylus, ooh, really nice. I like it a lot. So I'm enjoying that. There was an included USB-C cable in the box. Unfortunately, it's a USB-C to USB-C, and the bummer is I don't have any USB-C Macs. All of my Macs are older, so USB-A. That means I'm going to have to order up some new cables. I actually already did, so I'm getting some USB-C to USB-A cables. I understand why Apple's doing that in the box because, you know, moving forward, everything's going to be USB-C. But just something to think about if you are upgrading and you don't have a Mac where you can plug directly into USB-C. Now, the power brick itself does have a USB-C connector, so it makes sense, again, for the wall connection to your iPad, you're going to go USB-C to USB-C. And looking at the wall wart, it is 5 volts at 3 watts or 9 volts, or at 3 amps, rather, or 9 volts at 2 amps. So it does charge relatively quickly at the 9 volts, and that's when it's plugged into the wall. The speakers on the new iPad Pro, wow, do they go loud. I mean, it can get really, really loud. I put the sound up to about 75%, and it was about all I could stand. And I do have to say, I think they started to feel a little bit tinny and overdriven once they got above 75%. So it has great sound. I don't think they're actually distorting per se, maybe a little bit when you get up to about 100%. But regardless, you know, the volume at that level is really too loud for any sort of normal use. So I would say, you know, the speakers sound good. I don't think they're absolutely great. Are they an improvement over the older generation iPad, my first generation iPad? I would say in general, yes. They do sound better, just not great. I don't know that you can expect much from that small of a speaker anyway. I think the ones actually maybe on my iPhone XS, though, sound better than the ones on the iPad Pro. I'm going to have to probably do some more testing on that. But again, this is just my first general impressions having used it for, you know, a few days now. And then I think this last item is going to surprise many of you. Face ID works great on the iPad. I don't know if maybe for me it's because with the iPad I'm holding it a little bit further from my face. We've talked about the fact that I have, you know, older eyes, I wear glasses, and if I don't have my glasses on my face, I tend to raise my iPhone up to my face a little bit too close, at least too close for Face ID to work reliably. So I've gotten used to it. I'm better at, you know, bringing it up and making sure I hold it further back. But with the iPad Pro, it's been wonderful. It works most of the time. There's just a few occasions where I've run into trouble with it, but they're few and far between, and I have to say impressive. It's quick and fast, and I like it. I know, I just said that. I said it. So I'm, you know, coming around on Face ID. Also, like I said, I probably would at some point. I think it's going to get better over time, and it definitely is improving. So Face ID on the iPad Pro, the third generation iPad Pro, it is great. Now, just one little thing that I've noticed that's a little bit of an irritation, but I understand why this is, and it's just a matter of time before it's fixed, and that is third-party apps that are not optimized for the new iPad Pro screens. They don't go fully edge-to-edge, and they actually have pillboxing. So on the sides, they're narrowed in, and probably the most frustrating one for me right now is Netflix. It's very, very noticeable. You get about a black bar of about maybe a half of an inch to an inch on the left and right side of the Netflix application because it's not optimized to go edge to edge. When you have one of Apple's apps that is optimized to go edge to edge, it is very noticeable. It's also very noticeable when you have an app that's not optimized because that pillboxing is very prominent. So I'm not enjoying that. But to be fair, Apple didn't give developers any notice of the new screen format or screen sizes. So Apple threw it out there. It was announced. And a week later, the iPads were on the streets. Unlike, if you remember, the iPhone 10, which was announced 2 months before it actually shipped. So developers had time to get their apps ready. And to be fair, a lot of developers have already pushed out updates and optimized their apps for the new iPad Pro screens. So they're rolling out quickly. I think this is a problem that will be solved relatively quickly, but you will likely notice it if you get a new iPad that some of the apps aren't fully optimized to take full advantage of the screen. And you do feel that. I'm probably feeling a little bit more, again, because I already downsized my iPad from the 12.9 to the 11. And now when it's pillboxed or squished in a little bit, it feels like I'm getting even less screen than I was before. So I am noticing it. And then one other thing, not necessarily iPad Pro related, but a little user interface thing that I did notice that came up, and actually a listener brought it up to me as well in an email, is a change with FaceTime, which is updated in iOS 12 to bring in the group FaceTime capabilities. But Apple changed the user interface for switching the camera on your iPhone between the front-facing and the rear-facing cameras. You used to have this nice little switch button that was up there all the time in the interface. That is now gone. And I only bring this up because I was doing a FaceTime call with my brother this week, and I wanted to show him something. He noticed something behind me, and I'm like, oh, I'll show it to you. And it took me a couple seconds to figure out what happened to the little flip-around button. Not only that, is how they have you activate it now, it requires an extra tap, and when you're doing the switch, you can't get a preview because the panel that slides up to access the switching the camera button covers the entire screen. So you flip the camera around and you can't see what the camera is seeing because it's covered by the UI element, at least on the iPhone. On the iPad, it's not quite as bad. But what's happening now is when you're using FaceTime, you see everything in full screen. It goes edge to edge on your display. There's no buttons, no controls other than the preview window of the person that you're doing your FaceTime call with. You have to tap the screen, and then down at the bottom, you get a little slide-up panel that has the visual effects, things like accessing Memoji and stickers and all that sort of thing. And when you tap on that, there's another button you can tap on, and that gives you access to a slide-up panel that will allow you to change the camera orientation, switch between the front-facing and the rear-facing. And so I found that a little bit cumbersome and a little bit annoying. It's something to get used to, but I wanted to bring it up in case you're doing a FaceTime call and you're like, where did all of my controls go? They're actually hidden a little bit. And it's more of this move by Apple to what I call hidden user interfaces, where they're hiding buttons, they're hiding things. And frankly, I kind of don't like it very much, to be honest. I think discoverability is getting lost in a lot of cases, and it doesn't seem necessary because that little flip around button, that little icon, was very non-intrusive. It was small. It was up there in the upper right-hand corner. I think it could have been left there just fine. So I question some of the decisions Apple is making because it does make it harder to use the applications, especially if you're used to that button being there and now suddenly it's hidden and you're having to dig and find it and figure out where it's buried. This is something that Microsoft has done for years, is sort of burying settings and things down 2, 3, 4 layers deep in some cases, and Apple's falling into this trap. And I find it a little bit bothersome. I don't want to complain too much. It's not a huge deal, right? This is a minor inconvenience, but it seems to be cropping up over and over again. And it does just raise the question in my mind about where are we going with usability and discoverability in our applications. But there you go. Just some of my first impressions on my iPad Pro. I'm sure there's more I'm going to be sharing with you. And of course, if you want to share your own thoughts, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. The other thing I wanted to follow up on from the last episode of the MacCast was some of my comments about Apple's new pricing. There's a lot of folks in our community that are concerned and maybe even a little upset about Apple kind of across the board raising prices on their products. And I talked a little bit on the last MacCast about some of my ideas about why that might be happening, specifically the fact that with things like iPads and iPhones entering the ecosystem, a lot of us are finding that we are upgrading our devices less frequently. If we're buying a new Mac, we're maybe doing it every 4, 5, 6. In some cases, I'm hearing from folks, you know, people doing it after 8 years, 10 years of using their device. And that means for Apple that people aren't upgrading as frequently. That diminishes their yearly pool of, you know, revenue coming in. So they need to make up for that in some way. Same thing with iPhones and iPads. Our upgrade cycles are extending out longer and longer. And so Apple's sort of feeling, hey, we need to charge a little bit more. We'll try to add in more significant new features and also add more longevity to our products in terms of what we're adding in terms of performance and our software updates and support and stuff like that. That'll allow you to use your devices for longer. We'll recognize that you're going to upgrade less frequently, but in exchange, you're going to pay a little bit more up front to kind of cover those costs and spread things out a little bit. And so I was talking about that. And while many of you agreed with me, there were some people that wrote in and said, you know, I kind of think a little bit differently than you. You know, are we really getting more value from our current devices? Are we able to use them longer than we have been? Because Apple products have always been the case where they last longer or you use them longer than, say, PC products or Android products, something like that, where you might upgrade more frequently with those companies. Apple has had this history of, hey, you can use your Mac for 5 years, 6 years. And I often would have Macs that went, that I held on to. I went that long between upgrades. But it started to become less rare, and I think we're moving back in that direction. But regardless, Josh wrote in and wanted to ask a couple questions that I really wanted to address on this episode of the MacCast. He said, you know, are they really giving us added value that is more than what they've done in the past with their upgrades? Apple stuff has always lasted a long time. Is it really going to last longer now? Are the parts being made to have a longer lifespan? And Josh, I think that's a great question. And you're right. You know, Apple products have always lasted a long time. And with few exceptions, the components hold up, right? Apple uses quality components in terms of their memory, in terms of their storage products, and all those sorts of things. They tend to have, I think, lower failure rates than other products, similar products that are out on the market. Again, with exceptions, so don't email me. You know, I can talk to you all day long about the bad logic board failures that I've had in multiple MacBook Pros. There are definitely some exceptions, but Apple also tends to cover those things. They've taken very good care of me through AppleCare, through all of those products, giving me replacements or repairs for free within my coverage, of course. But again, I had those machines for a long, long time. I have not purchased a new MacBook Pro since 2010. Okay, so we're on 8 years at that point, and I would say that's pretty good. So no, you know, the components aren't necessarily lasting longer, but I think what's happening is that we are able to use our Apple products for longer because of things that Apple are doing in terms of supporting the operating systems, you know, on models going further back in the product line, or also just adding in components that perform longer and last longer in terms of performance, right? You're not feeling like the machine is running slow or too slow with the latest operating system after a couple of years. As a matter of fact, Apple is optimizing the operating systems for older products so that they run better. So that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about when I'm saying they're making their machines last longer. The other thing he questioned is, you know, he says, I think they're more worried about maintaining their profit margins than giving consumers something more. And he says, don't get me wrong. I understand that's what a business is supposed to do, is maintain a profit margin, but Apple is doing it by raising prices and not really giving us more or giving us more value. And I tend not to agree with that, but that's a little bit of a subjective thing, right? Everybody's experience is going to be a little bit different. And I'm feeling like the quality of Apple's products, you know, it's been maintained over the years. Has it gotten a lot better? No. But they are doing a lot more innovation, I think, a lot more research and development. They've always sort of done that, but something about it feels different. You know, technologies like artificial intelligence, like Siri, like they're investing in a lot more companies. They're investing in a lot more in-house technologies. They're designing and building their own chips, which we're gaining huge benefits from in terms of performance and longevity. Like there's a lot of these sorts of things that are going on that I think play into this equation. And a lot of them, I think the problem is they're not right up there up front for consumers to sort of glom onto to see, but they're there under the hood. You know, Apple is spending that money. They're making that investment. And that is also some of the stuff that we're paying for. Another question that Josh asked was, you know, are we really gaining something new here? We are Apple geeks. We love to get the latest and greatest every time it comes out. We don't want to be on a 2 or 3 year cycle. And I totally agree with that. The thing is like, I think we're going to have to get used to that because there's really two separate conversations going on here, I guess is the best way to sum this up. You know, there is the conversation of, are Apple's products worth the prices that they're now asking us to pay for them? You know, they're asking us to pay more. Is the value in there for most people when they're buying one of these products? And I have to say, if you've chosen Apple as your company, you've already kind of took on some of that. You already know that you're going to be paying more for an Apple product than you would for, say, a comparable product from another company. And comparable, again, that gets a little in a gray area, right? Because you can get something cheaper and it might just be something cheaper. And the component quality, the overall build quality might not be the same. Now, functionally, is it the same thing? Does it have the same Intel processor in it? Yeah, it might. But there still are some differences. So Apple's always delivered a premium product. We've always paid a premium price. Now we're being asked to pay more. So the question is it worth it? And I still feel personally that answer for me is yes. Each person is going to have to try and sort of decide this on their own for themselves. But for me, I think yes. The second separate conversation that we need to have is, will I get enough value when I upgrade to the next generation of a product to justify its price? And that really is a different thing. And I think that's more of what we're talking about and more about what people are responding to and more what I'm talking about when I say, you know, we're not going to need to upgrade every year anymore. Maybe not even every 2 or 3 years. That is extending out, and Apple is sort of forcing that on us. And I think a little bit of the price hit, you know, the price pain is about them saying, yeah, really think about this. You need this year's iPad if you already have a second generation iPad. And I think more and more the answer there is no, don't upgrade. You're crazy to upgrade. If you already have an iPhone 10, you very likely don't need a 10S. You may want one very, very badly. But the feature differences are just not that great. And there's a number of reasons for that. You know, the trouble for Apple is there is this slowing return on the innovation that they're putting into their products, right? A lot of their computers and iPads and iPhones are fast enough for most people for a longer period of time. They perform well enough over time. And that's both a good and a bad thing, right? That's a little bit of a double-edged sword. The thing about that is that doesn't necessarily reduce the cost or devalue the innovations that they're putting into their products. So, you know, one of the things you were asking about is, are they really giving us a lot more? And an example that I think of is, think about the TrueDepth camera system, right? Or the Neural Engine, or a Retina display, or True Tone, or a lot of these technologies that Apple has built into their products. These are great, amazing, innovative technologies. And they do a lot for us. And they also add, for Apple, a lot of cost, specifically with things like the TrueDepth camera system or developing their own processors in the Neural Engine. That is a huge cost outlay for Apple. To the consumer, though, you don't see that big of difference. Let's take TrueDepth, right? think about the True Depth camera system. It is a whole array of new components that are sitting there in your iPhone. And when you move from an iPhone 8 to an iPhone 10, there's a lot of technology there that has changed. It's costly. It's expensive. Apple had to develop it. And there's all of that behind it. But to the consumer, what has really changed? Well, I unlock with my face or I unlock with my thumbprint. Both work really, really well. Both are really, really fast. Both are convenient, right? It hasn't really changed in terms of your general experience, right? It's a biometric unlock and they both work very well. Now, they work differently and you might be able to, you know, make that comparison and you might argue, well, Touch ID is better for these reasons and Face ID is better for those reasons, but they each have their advantages and disadvantages, but they both work remarkably well. Now, what sits behind them and drives them, of course, innovating the Touch ID sensor, that was a big outlay. But over time, that gets reduced, right? So that is the kinds of things that are adding to the cost and I think forcing Apple a little bit to drive prices up. So they invest heavily in those innovations, and rightfully so, they want to get and recoup the costs of that innovation. But when I talk about sort of the diminishing returns for consumers, and it's not really diminishing, that's not a good word, because we do gain some great new technologies, right? We gain some cool stuff. But seeing the value of that, that's where it's hard to put across, right? It's hard for me to look at somebody who has an iPhone with Touch ID and say, oh, absolutely, you've got to go to Face ID. You know, it's worth $300 or $500 or whatever the premium is to go to that next thing. That is getting to be a harder argument. And so Apple is having to counterbalance that a little bit. And I think that is a little bit what's going on. You know, and here's another example. When I go in and I look at an iPhone XR, for example, and I put it next to an iPhone XS, I have to tell you, honestly, it would be almost impossible for me to justify to most people that they pay the price premium for the iPhone XS. The display on the iPhone XR is gorgeous. Is it as good? Does it have as high contrast ratio or brightness? Is it as energy efficient as the XS? No. But to the average person, it looks very similar and it performs the same function, right? It's a screen, it's a display, it does what it's supposed to do in both cases, and in both cases, it does that job very, very well. Does that mean that the iPhone XR doesn't have a, you know, or the XS doesn't have a better, more costly technology under the hood? Of course it does. It just means that the value gained by spending the extra money to buy that XS, it becomes a harder sell for most people, right? And so I think that's a lot of what we're talking about. And so just to sum up this part of the conversation, another thing, and this is more related to the value in the new upgrades for the MacBook Air and the Mac Mini, and just, you know, the longevity between updates and stuff like that. John Gruber was at the event in New York. He was talking to some Apple engineers, asking around, as he does. You know, he's really good at that sort of stuff, asking questions. And he asked Apple, or a few people at Apple, it sounds like, from reading his article, the big question, you know, why did it take so long for the MacBook Air and the Mac Mini updates to happen? What's going on here? And he says what basically he was told by a couple of people within Apple was that Apple wants to focus on what they're calling, quote, meaningful updates. They told him that basically the days of the speed bump, you know, just revving something with little minor speed bumps are largely over. That basically what we've been talking a lot about here, the value isn't there for the consumer for Apple to do that. They want to deliver meaningful updates that deliver significant value. And I think they're asking us to pay for that. And that's why we're seeing some of these price increases. And we're going to have to get used to that. And we're going to have to probably absorb that. And if that really, really does bother you, I think Apple's position is there are alternatives in the marketplace, and there's some great alternatives out there. You know, Windows ain't that bad anymore, folks, and there are some great things out there. And I know a lot of Mac fans are going to be maybe angry or sad or upset for me to say that, but I think we live in a great time when there's a lot of great technology options. I personally choose Apple for a lot of reasons, and I'm not moving away anytime soon. Is it going to be more painful to be an Apple fan in terms of buying products? Yeah, I'm going to have to spend a little bit more. What does that mean for me? That means I'm probably not going to upgrade as frequently. But it also means that I get to buy and enjoy the Apple products that I do buy for a longer period of time. And I think they are lasting longer, and their useful life is extending. And I think a lot of that is through and because of Apple's engineering and investment and in this idea of making meaningful updates, not just meaningful updates, but also meaningful products that deliver value for the price that you're paying. And so I think ultimately it's still there for me. But that's just my thought. Again, I want to hear from you, especially if you disagree with me. But even if you agree with me, shoot me some emails, some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. And I just want to finish up this conversation with sort of another side of it, or another part of it, I guess. And this discussion comes out of a thread that was linked to when I was going through my notes this week over on Reddit. I will have a link to this Reddit thread in the show notes at maccast.com. But there was kind of a group of Apple fans and Mac folks talking and discussing about some of the nickel and diming that they feel like Apple is doing in terms of recent product updates. And again, I think a lot of this stuff isn't new. It happens over time. We saw it with, you know, iPods and Macs back in the day. And a lot of it is the little kinds of changes they make between updates that a lot of times maybe we don't notice or sort of slipped in there, but do end up feeling just kind of cheap on Apple's part. And I'll just give you a couple of examples, and then maybe if you want to comment on them or maybe point out some others that have bothered you, you can share those with us at maccast@gmail.com. But, you know, a big one, number one on the list, you might have on the tip of your tongue right now, and a lot of us kind of feel the same way, and that is iCloud storage. The storage that we get for free, 5 gigabytes is all we get for free. And there's even been like rumors and thoughts that Apple might take that away at some point and only, you know, make us pay for iCloud storage. I think it could happen. I could see it definitely happening. And that would be counter to what a lot of their competitors are doing, right? There's a lot of cloud services out there that give you much more storage for free than Apple does. And it's a little bit frustrating with Apple because they want us to put more and more stuff into the cloud and to use iCloud backup. But if you have a new, you know, 256 gigabyte iOS device, guess what? You can't even back it up to iCloud because you just don't have enough storage out of the box for free. You're immediately having to pay a service fee. And, you know, Apple's services business is growing. I think there's probably a logical reason for it, maybe. But yeah, I mean, it does feel like Apple should be offering up a little bit more storage for free. I think at least 64 gigabytes would be reasonable, maybe more. But, you know, I don't think they're going to do it anytime soon. So that's one of the little nickel and diming things people brought up. Also, only using 120 or offering 128 gigabytes of flash storage in many of their base model Macs, specifically MacBooks and MacBook Airs and stuff like that. And the higher cost to upgrade those SSDs. You know, Apple charges a price premium. Now, I do need to remind everybody that Apple's fast PCIe flash storage that they put in their products is not the same quality or caliber at all as the cheaper SSD flash that you get in, you know, external drives or even internal drives that you can buy from third parties. Yeah, you can get, you know, a gigabyte or a terabyte rather of SSD storage for about $200 these days. You know, I can go on Amazon right now and buy a terabyte, you know, external SSD for about $200 to $250. Apple charges more like $400 for that upgrade. But they are not using cheap stuff. This is fast, super fast PCIe, and we can argue whether that's a good thing or not. Maybe they should be using the cheaper stuff and not charging a price premium, but that's, again, just now not how Apple has ever operated. But it does start to feel like a little bit of nickel and diming to a lot of consumers when they go price out their custom-build Mac and realize how much they're paying for flash storage. So that came up in this Reddit thread, and I know we've talked about that here on the MacCast. Just a few others real quickly. Not including a USB cord when you buy a replacement charging brick for your MacBook Pro. Yeah, I mean, could they throw a, you know, probably what it costs Apple, a $5 cable in there when you're spending $60, $70, $80, $100 on a charging brick? Absolutely. Kind of feels like they should, right? Because you still have to plug that thing in. You have to get from the wall thing to your Mac. Now, Apple might argue, well, we gave you one with your MacBook Pro. What happened to that? Maybe it wore out. You know, maybe that's one of the reasons you're buying a new cord. Would it kill them to throw that in the box? Something I immediately noticed with my new Apple Pencil, my Apple number 2 Pencil. Guess what? No extra tip in the box. My first generation Apple Pencil had an extra tip. You can, of course, buy extra tips from Apple. I think you get a 4-pack for about $20. They're not expensive. So why couldn't Apple just include one in the box? Or the Lightning to, you know, 3.5-millimeter headphone jack, or this year with the iPhone XS, a USB-C to 3.5-millimeter headphone jack. They included that in the first generation with the iPhone X. They took it out with the iPhone XS models, you know? Is that Apple nickel and diming? Are they cheaping out? Happens over and over again. If you get a MacBook or a MacBook Pro that does come with a USB-C cable, guess what? That cable's not a Thunderbolt cable. It doesn't support Thunderbolt. So if you need to connect a Thunderbolt device or a Thunderbolt drive, yep, you're buying another cable. None of this stuff is really new. We can debate and talk about whether or not Apple should be or should not be including it. I think Apple doesn't have to do anything necessarily, right? Again, they're a for-profit company. They're in the business of making money, and they do it better than a lot of other companies. People might counter-argue, well, they've got a, you know, they're a trillion-dollar company with billions of dollars in the bank. Would it kill them to give me a $5 cable? I don't think it's an unreasonable request. Either way, I kind of agree with both sides, and it's a conversation we can have. But, you know, again, I think it doesn't surprise me when they don't do this stuff, because historically that's the way Apple's operated, and anybody who's an Apple fan has kind of known that. So I don't know. I don't get too up in arms about it because maybe I'm used to it, but maybe that's a bad thing. Maybe complacency when it comes to this sort of stuff. Maybe I should be more outraged, but I just really, I'm not. But maybe you are. So share us your thoughts and opinions, maccast@gmail.com. And you know what? I think I told you we were finishing up. I see in my show notes we had one more thing to talk about, and I think this is an important one because it goes into that conversation we were having about longevity of Macs and holding on to Macs longer and keeping them for longer. So we've been discussing this here on the MacCast, and I realized it's been a while since we gave out any tips on this, like how do you keep older Macs up and running? What do you do with them? And this conversation also came about because I received a question from Brian, and here was what Brian was asking.
Hi, Adam. Brian from New Jersey, checking back with you again on something I've tried to solve and haven't been able to, like issues you've helped me with before. The issue I'm having, I'm trying to help my father out, and he's got an 8-year-old Mac Mini, and it's just painfully slow, sometimes unbelievably slow. I erased everything from it, formatted the hard drive, put everything back, and it was marginally better, but not really. I don't know what else to try. I got clean up my Mac we bought and ran on it, and it's just not getting better. I know it's 8 years old, but you know, just the show I was listening to today, you were talking about people with 10-year-old Max and perfectly happy with how they're going. A little slow. This is not a little slow. This is where you try to open mail and it might take an hour or 40 minutes, or mail opens, but then a message won't open for, it's something really wrong. So if you can help, that would be great. I'd appreciate it. I always appreciate you. Always appreciate listening. Keep doing what you're doing. And thanks for your help. Bye.
Hey, you are welcome. I guess it sort of in advance. I'm going to try and help you out here, and we'll see if we can get you pointed in the right direction. Now, you've already kind of given out part of the answer, I think. You know, old hardware is old, right? And at some point, you are going to reach that state where it just isn't servicing your needs anymore. So without knowing specifically what your dad is using his Mac for, it may just be, the answer might just be, you know what, it's time. That machine serviced you very, very well for 8 years, or serviced your father very, very well for 8 years, and it's just run its course. It had a nice, respectable run, and it's time to move on. It's time to get a new Mac, or maybe even replace it with, say, an iPad or an iPad Pro. Maybe he doesn't even need a full-blown computer, something that is a little bit easier to maintain, has less moving parts, and that sort of thing. That said, I don't think you're necessarily there yet. An 8-year-old Mac Mini could still be a very serviceable machine. It sounds like in this case, yours isn't right now, or your father's isn't right now. And there could be a couple reasons for that. It does sound like you did everything from a software perspective that you could do. You mentioned getting Clean My Mac and, you know, clearing things off there and cleaning it up. I'm going to make the assumption that you cleaned off the hard drive. And that the hard drive isn't extremely full, because that is something that can impact performance if the hard drive is, you know, and that will happen with older machines, right? Because maybe you have a smaller hard drive. Maybe it's only 250 megabytes or gigabytes rather, or it's only, smaller than that. I don't know. But if it is all the way full, the machine will run slowly. So just clearing off old files, archiving stuff, getting a little headroom on the hard drive, that can help, especially if you are lower in memory. Maybe you don't have enough RAM in that computer. So a RAM upgrade might be something worth looking into or considering. But if I were to guess, if I were a betting man, based on what you are describing and the age of the machine, I'm going to guess that it has a failing spinning drive. That the hard drive, while it might be seemingly working fine, it might even pass a disk utility scan or some other software scan. Those things just wear out over time. You know, they've got a motor in them, they spin, they've got moving heads, they've got all kinds of parts, mechanical parts moving around in there, and they just literally wear out. So my number one bit of advice, if you can't figure out anything else, is maybe consider replacing the hard drive. And if you really can, replace it with an SSD, which is the best thing you can do for any Mac in terms of making it feel new and refreshed and modern. If you have a Mac that is older than a few years old and it has a spinning hard drive, look at replacing the drive with an SSD. And they're getting fairly inexpensive. You know, for about $100, I think you can get a 512 gigabyte SSD for around $200, $250. You can get 1 terabyte of SSD storage. And it doesn't matter if you do internal or external. Internal, if you can do it, is preferred because it's going to give you better performance. But even, especially on an older machine, even an external drive, you know, having a USB 3 external drive, plugging that in and booting off of it, that's going to be faster, a lot faster than booting off of the internal spinning drive, if that's what you have, especially if that internal spinning drive is on its last legs and is failing. So for you, Brian, I would say number one, think about the hard drive and maybe replacing that and see if that doesn't fix a lot of the problems. I have a feeling it will, and you'll probably only have to spend $100, because I'm guessing if your dad's machine is that old, that adding a 512 gigabyte drive, internal SSD drive, is going to probably double his storage, if not more than that. than the current internal storage he has, assuming he hadn't replaced the original stuff. So I would do that. I already mentioned drive being full, maybe getting some headroom on there, upgrading the RAM if you can. Here's one. How dirty is the machine? You know, what about just cleaning it out, getting rid of dust that might be blocking up the fans or the cooling system? You know, heat is the enemy of computers. And if the fans are having to work hard or go full bore, or maybe even the fan has gone out, that's another motor that could possibly fail. You know, make sure that cooling is going properly on your machine. That might mean, you know, blowing some canned air in there and just flushing out the dust so that the cooling system can actually do its job. Mac OS, if it detects the processor is overheating or heating up, will actually ramp down the processor speed and slow things down on purpose to get the heat levels down to protect the system. So if your machine is constantly overheating, that could be a cause for slow performance. So another thing to consider. And of course, there's all the things you might want to do software-wise, cleaning out the cruft, getting rid of, you know, old files, doing a clean install of the operating system, which you already did. So I know you already did those things. So that was already, you know, tested out. But again, I think it's probably the hard drive if I were a betting man. Worst case scenario, it could be the logic board failing or starting to fail. And in that case, really, my advice would be after 8 years, just buy a new Mac. Don't even bother getting a logic board for the old Mac and trying to get it back up and performing. You know, if that's the case, it's time for a new machine. It really is. It probably is time for a new machine anyway, like the first answer that I came up with. And then finally, I would just say, if you're using older Macs or older hardware, have realistic expectations. You know, I think sometimes people expect these things to perform the way they did back when they were running the original operating system that they came with. They're not. You know, as software gets more complicated, as the operating system updates, Apple is trying its best to make sure that it's backwards compatible on older machines. But at a certain point, it's just going to fall over, right? So, you know, an hour, obviously, for opening up an email is ridiculous. It shouldn't be taking that long. That's the sign of a bigger issue, like you said. And I think it's a hardware issue related to the hard drive. But, you know, if it takes 10 seconds, 15 seconds to open an email on an 8-year-old machine, probably not all that unreasonable. Yeah, you'd like to work faster. If you're seeing beach balls maybe more frequently than you'd like, just wait it out. Be patient. It is old hardware. And if you really, if that really becomes bothersome or is really impacting your performance or ability to use that machine and get work done, then consider buying a new machine. It's probably time. So as much as I'd love old Macs to stick around for forever, and that doesn't necessarily mean that old Mac doesn't have some useful purpose in your environment. I am still using a 2006 Mac Mini on my network as a file server. It has a Drobo attached to it, and I do ChronoSync backups to it every night, and it performs and works great for that task, right? It can be relegated to something that it is appropriate for in terms of its processor speed, things like that. That machine, my biggest concern about it is it has to run an old version of the operating system. I think it's on Snow Leopard, and I think it's maxed out there. Like, I can't go higher. And so at a certain point, I'm going to have security issues with exploits. But the flip side of that is I don't think anybody's expecting a Snow Leopard machine to still be up and running, so they're probably not targeting it. I don't know. Anyway, hopefully this gives you some ideas and gives you some direction to move in and helps some other people out in the community. So thanks for your question. And now, for real, with that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank some of our sponsors and supporters: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great software by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. A big part of the support for the MacCast comes directly from listeners like you through Patreon. If you'd like to find out about how to support the MacCast via Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of the MacCast Patreon supporters out there. I really do appreciate you. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you'd like to find me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.